KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Myra. Coming up on Forum, we find out more about the Christmas Day tiger attack at the San Francisco Zoo. A Siberian tiger killed one young man and mauled two others. Then at 9:30, we discuss a new report on Bay Area potholes and cracked pavements. The roads rate fair. Can we expect better? Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Myro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Tatiana, a four-year-old Siberian tiger, somehow got free on Christmas Day at the San Francisco Zoo. She killed one young man and mauled two others before police killed her. But that's the full extent of what we know for sure. In this opening half-hour forum, we consider the implications of this attack for zoo managers. Dr. Joel Parrott joins us from Oakland by phone. He's with the Oakland Zoo. Hello, doctor.
Good morning.
Executive director, let me correct myself. And we also have Dr. Elliot Katz from In Defense of Animals, an animal rights advocacy group based in San Rafael. Hello, doctor.
Good morning. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning, Elliot.
Well, police aren't speculating just yet, but San Francisco zoo managers say the evidence suggests the victims teased Tatiana before she went for them. Does that seem plausible to you, Dr. Parrott?
It's definitely plausible that sometimes we get all types of, I guess, behavior that is inappropriate, and but it's still, we generally have to design for situations where the public does tease the animals.
So how do you protect the animals against that kind of thing?
You know, we try to protect them from a number of ways. If they're very sensitive to it, we'll put them behind glass where they can't hear the visitors very much, and then but usually the best way to do it is by distance, just setting the public back away from the animals that are most sensitive to that type of thing. We'll also, within the exhibit itself, design in a lot of hiding spots and retreat areas for the animals to get to. So when it's a really busy day and there are a lot of people out on the grounds, in front of the exhibits, the animals can kind of get away from it. And on really busy days, we'll actually leave the night house open so that if the animal feels stressed, they can just get away from it.
Dr. Katz, what's your theory?
Well, it's not a matter of theory. Dr. Parrott was talking about the Oakland Zoo. Now, that's quite the opposite on many of the, particularly regarding these large cats and Tatiana at the San Francisco Zoo. They have public feeding there. They bring the, make a fuss, they bring the public in. When it's time to feed the cats, the keeper was mauled doing this about a year ago, and they stopped doing it for a while. They started up again. This it titillates people, but what it does is it provokes the cat. It gets, because people want to see them growl. They want to see them act, aggressive. And this behavior has been happening for years with Tatiana. And I believe that's the reason why she had this aggression towards people. She had it towards a keeper. And it's simply a form of entertainment that the San Francisco Zoo, and we're calling on them to stop doing that. I don't know whether the Oakland Zoo does it, but it's grossly irresponsible. The cat house, as it were, is designed. It's an old-fashioned design. They put some improvements to protect the keeper after being mauled. But just bringing in people to watch the feeding process is wrong, because it creates a dangerous, a provoking situation. And sometimes the people, they get the thrill of watching the tiger, a giant tiger, growl or want that food. And that sets up this dynamic of that tiger being feeling angry, frustrated at the keeper and or the public that's standing there watching this situation.
I should mention we invited the San Francisco Zoo to participate in this conversation, but they didn't get back to us in time. Dr. Parrott, is this an industry standard public feeding frenzy, if you will, in cat houses in other American zoos?
you know, I wouldn't call it a professional standard. I don't know how many other zoos do it. We don't do it. I know San Francisco has been doing it for years. So I don't know what the rest of the profession does.
And they need to be held responsible because they they know it was simply for entertainment. They knew it was provoking. They endangered that keeper. She literally almost lost her arm. They did the same thing with the elephants, keeping the elephants on concrete and letting their feet rot away. There's a mentality in San Francisco that, in terms of the management there, that really needs to be revamped. They put entertainment first, and the animals suffer as a result. And I just want to mention earlier in your news program, it was mentioned that PETA was the organization that got the elephants out to the sanctuary. No, it was not PETA. It was In Defense of Animals, and I'm very proud of that. And proud also that Dr. Parrott spoke out on behalf of those elephants, too.
And Dr. Katz, you mentioned just a moment ago that, Tatiana, this particular tiger was involved in an attack on a zookeeper about a year ago. I've seen press reports that describe her attack on the young men, as tragic as it was, as a savage attack. But there's part of me that wonders, you know, tigers by definition are aggressive predators. They kill other animals for a living in the wild.
This Tatiana was born in another zoo. She was a little kitten. She was raised by people. So she, on some level, she should be the last one. But because of the way she was frustrated and with this public feeding, but being so close to the public, being taunted, they literally drove her to be this way, so aggressive that she would try to hurt her keeper initially and then members of the public. That isn't to say, I also go on record that say tigers need to be, should obviously, if they're going to be in a zoo situation, it needs to be a very, very good quality of life situation. Tatiana was not kept in that by the San Francisco Zoo.
I'd like to weigh in that. I think a lot of it, too, you know, you really can't look away from that. They have this a genetic makeup. Their DNA basically tells them to be predators. They're at the top of their ecology. You know, and so when you look at this one cat, you really can't call it a problem cat or a bad cat. Because really all the tigers are genetically programmed to be aggressive and basically be the top animal in their ecology. And the same thing can happen in elephants. You know, even in Oakland, we had one of our staff killed by by an elephant in 1991, and she was called a bad elephant, but the truth is all elephants in the wild will be aggressive because they're at the top of their ecology. And so when you come back to the tiger incident, you know, even with our tigers, which came out of the circus world, it's part of a circus rescue that we did with these, who have been around people the whole time, we wouldn't test them by opening the gate to see if they're going to be aggressive. We have to assume that they will be because the odds are they would be.
Are you saying that the public feeding that the San Francisco Zoo and that cat house that they have, you think that's they're acting responsibly to have had that happening for years?
You know, I've never seen it, so I'm just really, Elliot, hesitant to even comment on it. If I had seen it underway and how everyone reacts, and then I feel like I could comment, but I just would be speaking out of ignorance.
You know, Joel, I'm always trying to get to pull you into being critical of certain things, so I'm sorry.
Dr. Parrott, it is hard to speculate what's going to happen at the San Francisco Zoo as a result of this. One presumes they're going to be reassessing the way they run that operation. Does this whole incident, though, make you think maybe we should reassess the way we do things at Oakland if for no other reason than out of an overabundance of caution?
Oh, no, we do. You know, Jaguar attacked and killed a keeper in Denver not too long ago. Every time this happens, we all draw together and look carefully at everything from our own exhibit designs to especially to our policies and procedures, because most of the mistakes would be made in a keeper not double locking a gate or leaving a gate open or leaving the service gate open, and they don't realize the public can walk down there, and now they're suddenly in the back, you know, that type of thing. So we always reassess it. Most of invariably we come out reassured that everything is in place, but it definitely causes pause and causes us to go back and evaluate it.
I'd like to sort of bring up the fact of zoos tend to, when they bred the two tigers and Tatiana was part of the litter, it's under the guise of this is conservation. Well, zoos, 99% of their reason they're there is entertainment, and when they're setting up situations to entertain people. For the most part, the animals are going to suffer, and that's what the San Francisco Zoo has a terrible history of doing. The animals totally come second at the San Francisco Zoo as compared to the welfare and the well-being of the animals. And one of the reasons I'm proud to know Dr. Parrott is because that isn't the case at the Oakland Zoo. Him being a veterinarian, he has a sensitive veterinarian. He has the consciousness to do it right. But the San Francisco Zoo does not do it right, and they have the public needs to demand changes. And this whole guise of we're breeding large cats for conservation is absolutely nonsense. What they're trying to do is to conserve attractions because people like to see little babies born in zoos so they can get more foot traffic coming in. It's not for conservation. These animals are never going to go into the wild. Their habitat is being decimated. So, Tatiana was born in a zoo, she died in a zoo, and I don't think her life was one of very good quality.
Well, speaking of the public, we'd love to hear from listeners. If you're listening to this conversation and you've got a thought you'd like to share or a question you'd like to ask our guests, give us a ring at 1-866-SF-FORUM or 1-866-733-6786. I'll repeat that one more time, 866-733-6786. Dr. Parrott, if the biggest problem with big cats in zoos is aggressive humans, what's the best way for a zoo to manage it? Security cameras to watch the people?
No, I don't. I think the biggest issue is to make sure that the cats stay in their where they belong, which it would be in the exhibit, in what is their territory, and not let the people threaten that territory. So it's really it's a matter of video cameras, in my opinion, are worthless. You've really got to, that would catch a mistake after it occurred. It's way more important to make sure that a mistake never occurs. So really to make it so that the animals stay in and the people stay back, and so that you don't get the human-animal interaction between a guest and wildlife.
What do you make of Dr. Katz's assertion that we shouldn't even have big cats in zoos?
Well, I don't agree with him on that. And I think for those of us who are at least, and again, I can only speak to Oakland, they're actually, the greater cats are probably one of the best animals to have in a zoo because they acclimate so well. There are certain species that should not be in zoos, and they just don't acclimate well. They develop behavioral vices, they pace, sometimes they'll chew their tail, they're high-strung, they're nocturnal, whatever it may be. There are species that don't adapt well. The greater cats, if they're captive-born, especially if they tend to be hand-raised, where they feel reassurance from having a keeper, we do training in the back that most of the public knows very little about, but we do it mainly for veterinary reasons. And behavioral reasons so that the animals look forward to when the keeper comes back so that it's not a constant stress on them. The greater cats adapt to that perhaps amongst the best of any of the species that we keep in the zoo.
I'd just like to go on record that Oakland Zoo, Dr. Parrott Zoo, to a great degree is the exception. That consciousness is the exception to the rule. And it's the public demanding that the animals be given a quality of care that is pushing the zoos in the right direction. But most of them put economics, put greed, put entertainment far, far, far ahead of the welfare of the animals.
Well, let's go to a zoo visitor who's got something to say. Wendy in Sacramento. Wendy, you say you've witnessed taunting before.
I've been to a lot of the zoos around the United States. I've been to the San Francisco Zoo under 10 times. I've never seen the feedings, but I'm a zoo person, and I do a lot of photography, so I try to visit a lot of the zoos in the United States, and I frequently witness taunting by, you know, teenagers or families, and it always bothers me. And my feeling is that there should be more docents available at some of the larger animal exhibits, because it seems to lessen that when there's a docent or a volunteer or a zoo person near the exhibit, the people don't tend to,
People behave better if they know they're being watched by an official.
Yeah, one instance I remember specifically at the Sacramento Zoo was a guy was with his, I think, like 5-year-old daughter, and his a girl was with them, and they were at the lion exhibit, which doesn't have glass. The tiger exhibit does, and the lion exhibit. He was running from once he jumped over the little rail where there's like dirt, and then he was putting his hand in the cage and getting the male to come up and run back and forth. He got kicked out of the zoo, but he was just trying to entertain his kid because the lions weren't doing anything. And it happens, I see that stuff a lot at zoos. And if there were more people watching that were zoo people, it might not, because there were tons of people there and no one did anything.
So somebody in a uniform.
And that's because entertainment is the bottom line for zoos, and they allow these kind of things to happen because that's why so many people come to the zoos, to be entertained.
If I can comment, there's also a flip side of that, and I think as part of the zoo perspective is that, you know, this is the type of behavior that is a reflection of the understanding level of consciousness that people have towards wildlife and towards animals. We're in those cases, we're dealing with really the worst of the worst, and they need enlightenment as much as the more sophisticated visitor that comes out to look at it from a curatorial standpoint of the subspecies of the tiger and that type of thing. So, many of our visitors are so ignorant of the basic relationship that man needs to have with nature, that's really what you're seeing when you see it that far askew.
And I've seen very little on the part of most zoos that to deal with conservation and education and really telling people how to act respectfully. And all the times I've visited zoos, I've never seen anything that tries to give the visitors a feeling of respect these animals. They are worthy of respect. I've never seen it. People poke fun at them. Kids have fun making jokes about them. If anything hurts conservation, it's the way zoos portray animals. To me, it's almost devastating for people to make a joke out of these animals, and then the zoos to say, "Oh, we're doing this for conservation efforts."
Jim calls us from San Ramon. Jim, what do you make of that assessment? You've been to zoos yourself, I take it.
Yeah, I've been to many. I'd like to kind of ask the person from In Defense of Animals how many zoos he's actually been to.
I would say probably about 10 zoos.
Okay. My fear is that you're painting with a broad brush, and that I know I grew up going to what used to be called the Flyshecker Zoo. And I don't know if you've been familiar with that zoo and how long you've been going there.
Where was that located, Jim?
Well, that's the San Francisco Zoo. It used to be called the Flyshecker Zoo because those are the people that originally financed the formation of it. And my point is that the San Francisco Zoo has gone to great lengths and has made great strides in the past few years to make the zoo a much better place, and to just paint with a broad brush and say the San Francisco Zoo is totally a bad zoo, I just don't appreciate it, because they have made great strides, and you can brag about what you've done and what, you know, walk around and strut and say, I did this and I did that. But the point is that the San Francisco Zoo has done a lot, and I think zoos throughout the country have done a lot to make their zoo's a better place for the animals. I know I've been to the Oakland Zoo. They've got the habitat there, and that's a great place to be. And I think we've got to realize that there's another side to it, and that we need the philanthropy to support the zoos to make the kind of changes that they need to make, and maybe perhaps get away a little bit from the economics. I don't know how much money you've poured into the San Francisco Zoo. I've been a zoo supporter for years. But, you know, that's the key, is to support them.
Let's let the doctor answer.
It's not just the key to support the millions of dollars were put into San Francisco Zoo, and it was not put in to help the animals. It was put into eating places and entertainment for people. I'm a veterinarian. I'll be glad to show you the medical records of these animals, in particular the elephants. And it brought tears to my eyes when I saw how they were so terribly abused and mistreated until three of them died. And we finally got out one that was alive. And this is after I had been speaking to the director of the zoo for 3 years, trying to get him to get those elephants off of the concrete that was damaging and destroying their feet. I don't think you know what's going on, and if you did, I think you would be sick as your stomach as I am.
Well, let's go on to another caller now. We have Richard in Oakland, who I believe agrees with Dr. Katz that zoos... Okay, now we've got... Debbie in Mountain View, who says zoos are too much like Disneyland.
Hi, yeah, I'm a big zoo supporter and a PETA member, so I guess I'm a little bipolar. But when I go to the zoo, I have a tremendous respect for the animals and understand that they're wild animals. They're hardwired for their function in life, and I think the zoos need to do a little bit more of separating the human from the animal and making it a little bit less more of a Disneyland experience and saying, hey, you're seeing something that you may never see again in your life, and it's precious, and treat it more like, you know, these are living, sentient creatures that you need to respect, and they're here for you to learn about and respect, and this is not Disneyland. You paid your admission. These are wild animals. You are in their habitat right now, and you need to understand that they are wild animals. And I look at the age of these kids. They're in the zoo after closing. They're 18, 19-year-old boys. It certainly looks like there was a bit of, well, we're going to do some tiger taunting, and they lost. And
Dr. Parrott, from your perspective at the Oakland Zoo, are there zoos that do a better job than other zoos? I mean, leaving aside the Oakland Zoo, because, you know, we know you're going to have a bias there.
Yes, certainly there are certain ones that do it better than others. And, you know, we have an association, the AZA, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and they do an accreditation program. They certainly sort out that, you know, there are like 2,400, 2,600 licensed USDA facilities in the country. Only about 200 of them are accredited. And amongst those accredited ones, you know, some do a better job than others. Some do a better job in animal welfare than others. Some do better education or outreach or conservation programs than others. But everyone, I think, is striving for better, but it's really gets to be a matter of personal opinion on who is really doing a better job than others.
Well, gentlemen, we've come to the end of the first half hour of Forum. I want to thank you both and remind our listeners that we are talking to Joel Parrott, who joins us from the Oakland Zoo, and Dr. Elliot Katz of In Defense of Animals. Thank you, gentlemen, so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll be talking about potholes and civic pride, I presume, on the second half hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. The MTC, or the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, recently released a report assessing the pavement on more than 40,000 lane miles of local streets and roads in 9 Bay Area counties. The upshot? Pavement conditions are fair, or on the verge of deteriorating, depending on how far you read into the report. In this Forum segment, we talk potholes, municipal upkeep, and civic pride. Joining us are Amy Wirth, Orinda City Council member and commissioner for the MTC representing Contra Costa Cities, And Jim Sparing, Solano County Supervisor and MTC Commissioner representing Solano County Cities. Hello, Jim.
Hello, good morning.
Well, as far as you guys see it, is fair a fair assessment?
I think fair is an accurate assessment of the condition of our roads. For the last 40 years, we've seen a decline in funding for maintenance of streets and roads like many other infrastructure issues in California, and so this is what we're seeing.
And Jim, what do you think?
Well, you know, fair is just an indication of what's coming in the future. I really think if we don't find additional funding, fair is going to be probably the best we can see in the future in California. And so I'm very concerned that we're just at fair.
You know, I spent a few years covering transportation in L.A. City, and there it would take more than 80 years to pave all the potholes and bring all the sidewalks up to snuff unless the budget got an unexpected boost. How long do you think it would take to fix everything in San Jose and Solano and Orinda?
Well, I can give you a sense of numbers. Right now, we spend about $200 million a year. And if we continue that, we will see a serious decline if we just continue our current level of funding. So in order just to maintain the current level of fare, I think, as Jim indicated, we're going to need about $345 million a year. And to bring them back up, using your L.A. analogy, we're going to need to more than double the current investment, up to $450 million a year to pave the potholes. We really should be calling out instead of pavement condition index, our pothole condition index, because we probably have more potholes than pavement in many areas.
Well, do you have a game plan to take this one to the politicians and say, you should be doubling our budget because all those other important needs don't mean anything when you compare them to potholes?
Well, you know, when you look at just looking at Solano County, over our 20 years, we have a need of about $900 million of local streets repairs and maintenance. And right now, if you look at the money that's going to be available, it's about $370 million. We have a $533 million shortfall, and that number keeps growing every year. And so if we don't really start putting an emphasis on it, it's going to get worse. And unfortunately, what's happening here in Solano County is, you know, the county and the cities, we are now starting to use general fund dollars for this, which, as most people know, competes with, you know, basic services, police and fire. And so it really is starting to become critical funding for local streets and roads. And if we don't really start putting an emphasis on it, I think that the infrastructure in California is going to be in serious trouble for the next 20, 30 years.
Well, let's add a third voice to this panel, Dave Cortese, Vice Mayor of San Jose. Dave, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Well, what are we facing now? Fair roads headed for deterioration unless we double the budget or start dipping into the general funds?
Well, I don't know what the source of repayment is going to be yet. Everybody's scrambling and competing with the state of California for money right now at the local level. But as Commissioner Sparing just said, it's already deterioration underway. We've got degradation of our roads. I think most people realize that. The average person doesn't really need to hear that from us. They're experiencing it on the roads every day. But it's a much, much bigger problem, perhaps, than people realize. In San Jose alone, there's 2,310 miles of paved streets, so it adds up real fast.
You're president of the Association of Bay Area Governments. Is ABAG figuring out a game plan to tackle this problem?
Well, ABAG's working closely with the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. In fact, over the last couple of years, that relationship has grown stronger and stronger. The two agencies have actually formalized their relationship to work more closely together. ABAG is primarily charged with establishing the housing requirements for the Bay Area, as opposed to the transportation requirements. But as we all know, those two things are very, very linked. And if you're going to keep building housing, and we need to do that to some extent, especially affordable housing, there's got to be road infrastructure to get people back and forth.
Amy, anything surprising in this report? Anything where you thought, gee, I didn't know that?
Well, I think what it does show, if you look at the report, that as pavement gets worse, the decline gets faster. So, for example, what we're seeing is we're seeing cities that are moving down the curve. And in the next few years, what this report indicates, that the decline will accelerate. And so the cost of repairing, it's kind of like an engine. It's easier to change the oil than to replace the engine. And this is where we're getting with a lot of cities, that it really has shown that the deterioration is increasing. And transportation funding is a little bit like a layer cake. We look at a variety of sources to do that, federal, state, regional, and local. And if you ask what the future is, we need to look at ways of increasing essentially funding from all these different sources to prevent this further decline.
Federal, state, local. Could you throw in private? Mayor Gavin Newsom of San Francisco has suggested that part of the problem with the roads is you have all these private companies with, one presumes, big commercial vehicles ripping up the roads and not really paying their fair share, as it were, to fix the problem.
Well, you know, a lot of cities utilize those funds already. For example, in our community, we have garbage franchise fees. So the garbage trucks, the revenue that comes from garbage collection is used 100% of that to maintain the roads.
Well, we're talking about a subject that is near and dear to the hearts of just about anyone who takes to a car or bus in the Bay Area. So give us a call if you've got a comment you'd like to share or a question you'd like to ask the folks we have here today. 1-866-733-6786. That's 1-866-SF-FORUM. Give us a ring and we'll be happy to consider your call. So here's a question. I mean, we've got nine counties in the region. We've got a bunch of different cities. Presumably, we've have that many strategies to sort of tackle a looming need with limited resources. Is there anybody, Dave, who's doing something out there on the edge, revolutionary, innovative, that other cities could copy?
Well, I don't think there's honestly that much innovative that's going on. As people have said already, we're competing for precious dollars at the regional and state and federal level. And, of course, the regional bodies help to determine how that money is doled out. What you're really seeing, I think, at the local level is people pulling out the old bag of tricks, if you will, things like benefit assessment districts and community facilities districts, which goes that goes back to your earlier question about how about private funding. The problem is over the last few years, a series of court cases at the constitutional level, at the Supreme Court level, have made it very, very difficult to assess those kinds of charges to local developers and local landowners. The rule has been that there has to be an absolute direct relationship between the burden caused by those landowners and the actual damage that's being done to the streets. And as you start trying to fix 2,300 miles of streets in the city of San Jose, for example, you don't get very far away before the court system says, hey, you're too far away from that local development. So, but nevertheless, we're trying those things. We're trying to put some of those into action. At some point, the hope is that the local developer community will see that this is not good for them either. And one of the tools that you can use is voluntary developer agreements where they say, look, we want to build. We understand that there's infrastructure problems. We're willing to negotiate some extra money for streets. So those are all things we're trying to do.
It's interesting to point out Oakland's Public Works Agency has a strike force they send out to handle some of the worst potholes. But there are people who say that it's better, it's more efficient and more effective to take care of things before they get to the point of requiring a strike force. And along those lines, I'd like to invite Vic from Livermore, who is calling about Berkeley's road situation.
Good morning. I spent a lot of time in Berkeley and watched the streets disintegrate, and the city says right up front that there's no money to maintain the roads, but when the roads get really bad, there's county funds or funds from some local agency, not Berkeley funds, that allow rehabilitation of roads, you know, every 20 years. So they just sit and watch them disintegrate, and then, you know, so those funds being available for rehabilitation, I think, work against the interests, of the citizens and the county.
Knowing there's a backup plan, an emergency plan, essentially, lets them fall back on it.
Yeah, I don't really think there is an emergency or backup plan. What it is we're moving resources from general maintenance, where we would do overlays in the past. We are now just doing crack sealing and slurry seals, and we're taking the money that we'd normally rebuild those streets with, and we're fixing those very bad streets that he's talking about. And so it's just a matter of how we're moving the money around, and other streets are just getting worse over time. And so the maintenance, just the basic maintenance, is what's being deferred.
Jim, is this what's happening basically in most cities, that the maintenance crews are playing a game of catch-up instead of trying to think ahead?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as I look at the cities in the county up here in Solano, the cities like Vacaville and Fairfield, who traditionally always overlaid their streets, now you're seeing a lot more crack sealing and this slurry sealing. And the only reason they're doing that is to be able to defer some of those dollars to the streets that are really the worst or they're getting the most complaints on.
Well, let's hear some of those complaints. Let's go to Dave in Vacaville, who I understand has a few issues to raise.
Okay. Basically, when I was an engineering student like 25 years ago, it was one of our ethics discussion items about the difference between European and United States contracts.
Dave, you're breaking up there a little bit. If I can recommend, Dave, if you can still hear us, try calling back from another moment, from another phone. Let's move on to Joe in San Francisco. Joe, what do you think?
Okay, 18.5%, 8.25% sales tax, 18.5 cents for every gallon I put in my tank, state and federal, 24.5 cents for every gallon of diesel I put in my truck. I hear these guys sitting there telling, oh, we have no money, we have no money. I'm watching a street being worked on right now by the county of San Mateo. Now, we have all this money going into this. It's just in a general fund. Why don't we put the money, Mr. Mayor, Vice Mayor of San Jose, Mr. Councilman of Solano County, and put it towards what needs to be done instead of spreading it all around and trying to help everybody else out?
Well, Joe, let's take this question, I guess, to Amy Worth, not to leave Orinda City out.
I think one of the challenges is that a lot of the money that voters allocated in the state for transportation because of the budget crisis end up getting deferred to other critical needs in the state. Most of the counties in the Bay Area have a local sales tax. 18% of that goes to maintaining local streets and roads. And when we've all scraped our budgets, we've realized that there just isn't sufficient funding to take care of the really significant road and repair and maintenance that needs to happen.
Hold on. No, I'm going to argue this one.
Okay, Joe, what do you have to say?
Okay, why don't you put it into the fund it was supposed to? Tell this to Arnold Schwarzenegger. Tell him put it into the fund that it's supposed to be put into. Quit spreading around to new city halls and new schools. Put that into the fund that needs. Trucking companies pay enough in sales tax.
Well,
guys.
Joe, let's put this back to Amy again.
You know, that's a very good point. And one of the things that the Metropolitan Transportation Commission will be doing in the coming year is spending a lot of time in Sacramento fighting to preserve transportation funding. Because, as you know, you put gas in your car, your truck, and your expectation is that those gasoline tax dollars are going to be going to help maintain the roads that you're driving on. And this is really a critical issue. One of the things we've done is we did some polling and indicated that people in the Bay Area are willing to pay additional fees for both maintaining their local streets and roads as well as preserving the quality of air in our Bay Area.
Well, we've got one of those people now on the line from Berkeley, Todd. Todd, would you be willing to pay a little extra?
Definitely.
Whoops. Have we lost?
Sorry, making sure I'm not losing my mute button here. Definitely. That's the whole point. I don't understand if there isn't an outrage now about paying over $3 a gallon gas. I mean, there's people still using the roads. There's not like a protest going on about the fact that we're paying money through the nose to pay for Bush's wars and whatnot. I don't think a 25-cent per gallon tax would even be noticed by people. That wouldn't affect how much traffic is on the roads, and they'd make it better roads for it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Todd. Well, Jim, let me put this question to you. I mean, I imagine there'd be quite a few people who'd be willing to spend more money if they knew that it was actually going to the purpose they expected it would go to, as Amy was pointing out. Are politicians and on the local and the state level using these funds as a grab bag for other purposes?
I would say that the state and the federal government are using it as a grab bag. And local government, I really believe, have the same sentiments as the previous caller, that if we're going to collect gas tax money, let's put that money where it's supposed to go. And that's been a position of MTC for some time. You look at both the state and federal dollars with the Transportation Trust Fund, a lot of these dollars are being diverted, and that's what's causing a lot of this shortfall. And so I couldn't agree with the caller more. And but we have been working very hard. But when you have a state that's looking at a $10 billion shortfall, they go after all the funds that they can flex.
Well, I'm going to throw the next question to Dave Cortese from San Jose. Dave, you know, one of the emails that we've just received suggests that, you know, we wouldn't have to worry so much about the streets if we just expanded our public transportation system to carry more people.
Well, of course, over time, you know, that's the goal. Public transportation competes for dollars as well. It costs a lot of money to put buses on the streets and even more to put rail down. We're all working on that very aggressively, and it's kind of a balancing act, of course, because you know, you can't have potholes littering your roads in exchange for brand new rail going down or other projects. So that's something that the MTC, you know, grapples with literally on a weekly level, if not a daily basis, and we're working on it very hard. But when you look at where we need to go in terms of climate change, in terms of the greening of California, I think there's quite a possibility that you'll see more and more incentives for money to go toward public transportation and more disincentives for people to get in their automobiles besides just the high price of fuel.
I suppose it's worth noting as well that, you know, if the road is bad, it's bad for bicycles and buses as well as single passenger vehicles. Once again, let me give out that number if you've got some stories or questions you'd like to share. 1-866-SF-FORUM. That's 1-866-733-6786. You know, we haven't even touched on sidewalks yet, but that can be a real issue. And one of the things that, you know, sorry to bring up Southern California again, but there is a program in Los Angeles City where you can pay money. I think it's something along the lines of $1,000 to move to the front of the line so that the sidewalk in front of your house is fixed first. Is that where we're headed, Amy?
Well, I think what we're doing in the Bay Area, which perhaps is a little different, is we're looking at it from a comprehensive standpoint and realizing that every city and county in the Bay Area needs to have additional resources to fund the repair and maintenance of streets and roads. I think you're going to look at, we're going to see more and more public-private partnerships. Dave mentioned the idea of developers realizing that infrastructure is an important part of what they do. So we're looking at some of those ways of providing some additional private funds.
Let's go now to Alice, who's got a question about sidewalks. Alice, what would you like to ask?
Yeah, I was wondering myself whether sidewalks are part of the same general funding procedure as roads, and I'll just mention my situation in Pedro Point in Pacifica. Terrible. The city basically won't complete the sidewalk structure. It waits until somebody builds a new house, and then they have to, you know, complete the sidewalk in front of their house. As a consequence,
sort
elderly
of cost
people
shifting.
And children. Well, elderly people and children walk in the streets, and I find it very unsafe. And I generally won't walk my child to school, which I would otherwise do, if there was a completed sidewalk system.
Any thoughts on that, Dave?
Well, that is the way it's generally handled and has been for years and years. And I say generally, there's a kind of a pay-as-you-go system, you know, among most local governments. So that what's really trying to happen there is the local governments are trying to essentially do local residents a favor and say, look, we aren't going to form an assessment district or even attempt to form one. We're going to make the next developer that comes in is going to have to build the sidewalks along the frontage of his project. However, the caller shouldn't give up, because there are local grant funds and sometimes even state grant funds and available for filling in sections that haven't been filled in. And I think what happens a lot of times when people call City Hall or their county government, they hear that general response. You know, well, that's just the way it is, and you're going to have to wait until development occurs because that's normally the way it happens. You need to ask that next question. Well, isn't there a way to expedite that? Are there any grants available? Are there any ways that my neighbors and I can get together and help fund that little stretch that's causing problems for people in wheelchairs or kids trying to get to school? You'll be surprised oftentimes that there's very positive answers to those questions.
It sounds, though, like you're suggesting that individuals become essentially community activists trying to pull together funding from different sources to get what seems like it should be a basic given in urban life.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. That's exactly what I'm saying. And 7 years ago, when I first joined the city council, became a full-time elected official in San Jose, that's the thing that amazed me the most. People often ask me, they say, what is the most surprising thing coming out of the private sector and becoming a full-time elected official? What was the most surprising thing about City Hall? And my answer is all the resources that are available there if people will just ask the question. So it doesn't mean we have a lot of money. We're not, you know, backtracking on the earlier comments. It means that there are a lot of programs out there that are available to people in neighborhoods who are willing to organize and seek that money out.
Well, let's go back to the phones now. Dave in Vacaville is back with us. Dave.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment about the difference between European and American contracts to build roads. My understanding is that in Europe, specifically Germany, when a company gets a contract to build a road, part of that contract is maintenance of the road over the life of the road. So it's in their best interest to build it, you know, very good foundation, very deep. You know, they mix tires and stuff in the road so it lasts longer. Whereas in America, it goes to the typically cheapest bid, and once it's done, it's the city's responsibility to maintain the road.
Jim Sparing of Solano County, what do you make of that proposal?
Well, it's very interesting. It's just a matter of how you allocate those resources again, and you have to come up with the money to do the original construction. Right now, you're not seeing a lot of new construction here in Solano County. Most of the stuff we're seeing is maintenance. It's how do we maintain the existing system? And so, you know, I think innovative approaches like that for new streets and roads, I think those are the types of things we're starting to take a look at. You're even hearing about privatization of many of the facilities. But, you know, our particular problem, our focus really right now is maintaining what we have on the ground.
I'm hearing a lot of comments about privatization. What does everybody else on this panel think? Amy?
Well, I think that we have to look at all the ways that we can bring in resources. In our community, we've talked about adopting a street or adopting a sidewalk. I think that the key issue, though, here is that you have maintenance and then rehabilitation. And we're right now at the point where we're grappling with maintenance. But ultimately, as the system declines, the cost of rehabilitation is so much higher than maintenance. But I think clearly we need to look at all the ways of providing some additional, you know, private resources as well as public resources to fix the problem.
And Jim? Or I should actually say Dave, right? Because Jim was the one who suggested the last day.
The bottom line is everybody in the Bay Area who's either appointed or elected to any kind of leadership position, whom I've ever run into, is committed to this idea of maintenance first and taking care of what we're responsible for currently before we get too creative about launching new projects. And you know, what Jim said is actually, what both Jim and Amy said are both exactly true. I remember after being elected to the San Jose Council, I ran into a neighborhood who was complaining very vehemently that their street was the only street in the neighborhood which wasn't getting a slurry seal on a regular basis. Well, they were right. The street was so bad that you couldn't slurry seal it, and the next level of cost for rehabilitation was so high that the city, quote-unquote, couldn't afford to budget it or appropriate money for it. We got that fixed because that neighborhood organized around that issue. But that does happen, and that's the danger that we're sort of on the precipice of.
Well, let me ask a different kind of question, which is right now we're talking as if the costs are presumed, the approach is presumed. Are there other ways to be paving our roads, different materials we might be using? Oakland, for instance, has been testing pervious concrete, which essentially it means it's permeable. Water can go through and under instead of pooling on top and creating. So are there new technologies that we can be using that will help drop the cost over the long term? Amy?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we received a additional grant to rehabilitate one of our streets, and we're using some of the new asphalt. And it's stronger, it's quieter, and it lasts longer. So I think that we're really going to need to rely on technology to improve the paving materials that we have. And that's part of MTC has a working group of road maintenance professionals, and one of their strategies for the future is to look at, very closely at ways of improving how we do the paving that we do and using technology to benefit that.
Well, let's keep hitting the phones. We go now to Irvin in San Francisco. Irvin.
Good morning. I was very surprised to hear the responses from the panelists to the caller who had complained about the diversion of gas tax funds. The real diversion has been historically from the general fund to road funding purposes. And in fact, if you look at the California state gasoline excise tax, which is currently 18 cents a gallon and has historically been the main, if only, source that's been used to keep roads in order, in working shape, it's remained unchanged since 1994. Now, I certainly don't...
That's a good point, Irvin. I'm going to jump in because we just have a few seconds left for Amy to offer an answer to that. I can see her chomping at the bit.
I am, and I think that's one of the most important facts, that the gas tax is not kept up with the cost of construction, maintenance, and rehabilitation of roads. And so where people think that they're paying at the pump to do all the work that needs to be done, clearly... it isn't meeting the current costs of maintaining streets and roads.
Well, I want to thank our panelists. We have Amy Wirth, Orinda City Council member and commissioner for the MTC, representing Contra Costa Cities, Jim Sparing, a Solano County supervisor, and Dave Cortese, vice mayor of San Jose. Thank you all for joining us. You've been listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to hear special coverage from the BBC about the assassination of Benazir Bhutto of Pakistan. Thanks for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.